Blog Talk Radio.
It's May 4th, 2010, and you are listening to the weekly financial roundup with the Optimistic Bear. And this week, we have a lot of stuff to talk about. Our show, actually, our theme for the show this week is dedicated to the wonderful world of sovereign debt. And we have some of my regular guests online, and we'll be discussing that shortly. But just to let all of the uninitiated in on the secret of our show. This is the place where armchair economists rule the roost, where we don't claim to know anything about or have any professional knowledge about finance, economics, or anything related to that, but we sure love talking about it. And we love to hear from our listeners, so call in. The number is area code 917-388-4810. We'd love to hear from you and hear your thoughts and ideas at any time. And so, welcome to the show tonight, guys.
Hi, Michael. This is Elliot.
Hi, Michael. This is Jim.
Hi, Jim. I'm glad you guys could call in tonight. So, before we get into the main theme of tonight's show, which, of course, is sovereign debt, I'd just like to hear from you guys what your thoughts are on what's been happening in the markets this week already. There was a big rally and then a big decline today. Is this just noise?
Well, we've definitely been getting a lot of volatility ever since we had the VIX sell signal from a couple of weeks ago. That actually happened, I think, about 3 or 4 days before the final peak. We had a nice sell-off, and then the market rallied intensely. It seems like we've been sort of doing this sort of seesaw of sell-offs and rallies, but they've all been pretty big moves for the past couple of weeks. So ever since that signal kicked in, volatility has been increasing. And in addition to that VIX sell signal, we had a pretty big RSI divergence. So basically what that is that as stocks approach a high, a final high, they will tend to make a new high in terms of price, but not a new high in terms of momentum. So there's just not quite as much buying power in the final high. So, you know, in terms of looking at sort of short-term technical stuff, there was a nice little setup for a sell-off. I think we're definitely seeing that now. What happened today that I think was particularly interesting that has not happened yet is that it did break the small little lower trend line going back. That's held throughout this rally since February. So I think today might have been pretty technically significant. So I don't really know. This could just be another correction, but I think because of the break today, we're going to move a bit lower over the next few weeks. That's my best guess. But, you know, like we talked about last week, I won't be convinced this is a really big move. I have my suspicions, but I won't be convinced until we break the February lows. That's my basic opinion.
Somebody else has joined us in the call. Who are you there?
Hey, Mike, it's Jeremy.
Hi, Jeremy.
I thought I'd be fashionably late tonight.
When you have the aura of importance that you do, you're entitled to that.
Why, thank you, Michael. Those are my thoughts as well.
So do you concur with Elliot's take on the market decline today, that this is too early to tell if it's anything meaningful?
Yeah, I think I'm on the same page with Elliot. First of all, you know, we definitely needed to turn down a little bit. We'll see where it goes. But, you know, when you look at the VIX, like Elliot pointed out, even when you draw the trend channel from the beginning of this uptrend back in March, we slightly broke above the trend channel down in the VIX, but we didn't close above it. So, you know, it would be great to see us kind of break out of that. And then the trend channel in the Dow and the S&P, the Dow is approaching the bottom trend channel of the entire trend channel from the beginning of this entire rally back in March. So, you know, it would be great to see that break down as well. And we're really close on the Dow. We're a little bit further off on the S&P. But, you know, those are sort of the technical things that we'd like to see come apart. You know, looking across the sectors, the financials are looking pretty weak, especially with what's been happening with Goldman Sachs. But, yeah, I think we just need, you know, maybe another week of trading and see where things go before we can start to really sort of lean on the bear side. So, yeah, I think I'm on the same page with Elliot.
And what's your take, Jim?
I think this is just a minor correction, and we're headed for more highs and may not see the end for a month or two.
What kind of highs are you looking for, like 12,000 in the Dow?
Oh, well, maybe 1250 in the S&P. But on this last rally to highs, we didn't really see any divergences, for instance, in a lot of increase in new lows. And quite often you see an increase in new lows when you're making a high. So, I mean, basically I haven't really seen any chinks in the bull market at all. And this is just a normal correction that's probably not going to run more than another day or two. And we'll be rallying again.
Well, I'm sure there's many people who are glad to hear that. Yeah, well, it's of course, it's never a fun thing to have the markets totally tank, but still, it's good to have some thoughts of where things are headed.
Well, I'll tell you my opinion back in 2007, speaking of, you know, whether it's pleasant or not to have the markets tank. If you're a bear, then initially having markets turn down can be quite great, just because the market moves much, much faster on the downside than on the upside. So the opportunity there, you know, what you could accomplish in a bull market in a year, you could do in a couple months or so in a bear market. So it's nice from that perspective. But I'll tell you, back in 2008, I was not enjoying the bear market anymore once you started getting near the lows and layoffs were going about. And suddenly I realized this is not some fun and games, you know, playing with numbers on the computer anymore.
Yeah.
You know, this is stuff matters. This is real. This is impacting people and the economy. And it's like, this isn't fun anymore. I don't like this. So I think that's the same thing. You know, I think everyone's having fun now. You know, well, not everyone, but, you know, things seem to be a little bit relieved. And if we turn down, I think a lot of bears will be happy about that, but I don't think anyone's going to be happy if we really go down like some of us think it will.
Well, my take is as I've mentioned before, is a little nuanced in that I'm not enthused by market downturns, but I actually feel better when there's big corrections in the economy, because then the rot is getting fixed. And I actually get more and more stressed when I see the economic fundamentals get more and more out of alignment. That actually causes me more stress in my life. and as bad as things get, and as you all know in my own personal experiences, I've felt the impacts of down economies as well. You know, that's not a good experience. But on the other hand, I feel somehow optimistic that this is helping, that it helps purge the system, it helps get things back to to a more rational basis. So maybe this is just, you know, total wishful thinking on my part, but that's how I view it. So,
yeah, you know, I agree with both of you guys. You know, it was really, I don't know. I mean, I've been looking at this stuff for quite a few years and was sort of expecting the downturn, although it took a lot longer than I think, all of us had expected back in starting in 07. And living through that and going through that, especially near the end when things really started going crazy, it was a tough time because, like you say, you don't know, are you going to lose your job tomorrow? You don't know what's going to happen. You see your friends and family dealing with issues. You see people that you know getting kicked out of their houses. And although you had read about it and you thought that you had prepared yourself psychologically for some sort of event like this taking place, you really aren't there because you just don't know. You don't know what's going to happen, especially things like you know, we saw, well, just this weekend we had an attempted terrorist attack, and thank God it was by someone who wasn't sophisticated enough to actually pull it through. But, you know, these are sort of the random instabilities that are currently facing us right now, and you don't know if that's going to happen in your backyard or if you're going to be affected by something like that. So it was really scary times. And, you know, but this, I tell you, what's amazing is how much 1 year can make and how, you know, how people are just now at this point so optimistic about where things are going from, with respect to the economy.
So, gentlemen, sovereign debt, the topic of the week, and to give some context on this, we've been seeing it all this year, actually. There's been this continual news coming out about Greece and the problems that they've had with their financing and how the country is in deficits that they can't seem to get out of, and that they're getting worse, and they've been looking for bailouts from the European Union and from the IMF, and we continually would hear politicians, the Greek prime minister and other European politicians, say, oh, there's no problem, everything will be fine. But then as weeks go on, we see the credit default spreads on Greek debt continue to increase, and then start to see the contagion spread to other nations, Portugal, Spain, Ireland, and other nations are seeing some of the insurance, these credit default swap insurance rates on their debt is going up. We saw rating agencies downgrade Greece eventually recently as well, the national debt, and all this leads one to wonder: is any country's debt really safe? And I mean, because now we hear countries like Spain and Portugal, that we hear their national leaders saying there is no problem. In Italy, they're being adamant. Their national leaders are saying there's no problem here. There's nothing wrong with our nation's debt. But yet, you know, you really wonder how much can we trust what these guys say, because they really have no control over it anyway. It's whatever the markets do.
Right. And Michael, if you look at credit default swaps on some of those other countries you mentioned, Spain in particular, they're following the same course as Greece. They're just spiking up incredibly, and they're way above where they were at the peaks during the credit crisis in 2008. So this is pretty serious. The situation there is a lot more serious than it was then. And so it's really amazing to me that we can have this type of a problem in Europe. And, you know, with the exception of the past week, it seems like people aren't really aware of it, or at least it hasn't been affecting the U.S. much. It certainly seems to have had an impact on the euro, if you're looking for a trigger for that.
But does this really matter? I mean, is this just a short-term panic thing? I mean, look, we've been through this before. We saw there being a panic on Argentine debt. I mean, back in the early 2000s, there was crisis sweeping South America with Argentine debt going crazy, and we saw even Brazil. There was a bunch of countries. Even Turkey was having problems. Well, all of those problems went away. And people, heck, people have been buying Argentine bonds for years now, even though they defaulted on the bloody things years ago. So, I mean, investors don't seem to care whether countries default. They jump right back in with the shark anyway. So, I mean, isn't this just the short-term news and it'll blow over and people will be right back buying Greek euro bonds in another 6 months?
Yeah. You know, there's a saying about sovereign bonds. I don't know who said it, but it's a great quote. Maybe I'll try to figure out who said this. I'll comment. But the quote is, a bond is a certificate or sovereign bond specifically is a certificate of guaranteed confiscation, which I think is kind of a nice name for it because, you know, governments are generally quite irresponsible with their spending, and most of these sovereign bonds seem like a great investment for a long, long time, but they always seem to reach this hot potato state where a bunch of people end up losing and then they play the game again. You know, I actually had a roommate from Russia who was telling me he lived in Russia right before their default when their bond, the interest rate on their bonds went up to 80% before they finally threw in the towel, which I couldn't believe. But he said it wasn't so much just, you know, the irresponsibleness of the government, but it was also this irrational bullishness on the bonds almost. They said that all his friends and everyone he knew, they were all buying the bonds because they were, look how high the interest rates are going. We got to buy these things because, you know, you double your money just on interest. So I thought that was really strange. And he said a lot of his relatives were buying them, but he stayed out and, you know, worked out for him in the end.
Well, I remember reading back when there was the Argentinian default years ago. I remember reading how there were a lot of I don't understand why, but there were a lot of individual Italian investors who bought Argentine bonds, and they were. And one of the articles I remember reading was talking to some Italian investor, like an individual who bought Argentinian bonds, and he was saying he was going and buying more. Because he was saying that he couldn't buy normal bonds of other countries because the yields were too low. So he's saying, I can't buy American T-bills. I can't buy German T-bills because I need to have more of a return. So instead, he'd rather go and buy bonds from a country that actually just defaulted on bonds that he held. And now he's buying new bonds from that country because at least they're giving him a yield, which he needs to have.
Well, I think getting back to your question around whether or not it's serious, I think one thing to consider is the concerns around the contagion fears and whether or not this recklessness is going to spread now across the other countries, whether it's Spain or Italy. And you know, Greece only makes up a certain percentage, a very small percentage, I think it's like 6% of the overall EU economy. But if it starts to spread to the other countries, then I think that's where the significant fear is. What I think is kind of interesting, though, is watching the markets over the last couple of months and their movement into fear and then out of fear and into fear and out of fear. This has got to be our sixth time through this, I think, over the last 4 months, the market slightly selling off because of concerns of Greece and then the government's reassure. So it's kind of interesting to see this up and down movement. I think there's still some risk there because I believe the Greek government can veto whether or not they actually accept it. So I think there's some risk around whether or not they're actually going to accept the fund.
Well, aren't there some conditions attached to? Aren't there conditions attached to the bailout things as well?
Absolutely. So that's where the pressure is going to come. The austerity measures and whether or not how much money they can actually spend going forward. And then the next piece is. And I think it's sometime this summer when the next, amount of debt ends up rolling over as well. So, you know, this is only going to get them so far, and essentially it's going to evaporate. This money is going to go, into the Greek debt, and it's just going to disintegrate because it's, debt worth owing. And then they're going to need more when it comes to the summer. So, you know, and you have to remember, it's not only Europe that is affected by this, but the IMF is also putting up money as well, which means that the U.S. and Canadian taxpayers are going to be on the hook as well. And I haven't really seen too much dissent in North America yet on that. Maybe I just haven't seen it. Maybe you guys have. But I think it's kind of interesting that the IMF is getting involved as well. And what that means is that, you know, U.S. and Canada taxpayers are on the hook as well.
Well, on the face of it, and superficially, I can somewhat sympathize with these political leaders of countries that are in a financial crisis who complain about it and will talk to the blue in the face that there's really nothing wrong with their country. And what I mean is this, is it does seem almost irrational that you can go from being having a relatively easy bond market and low yields in your country's debt 1 month to just 3 or 4 months later all of a sudden have all of that change when nothing fundamentally really changed in your country. Why does it happen all of a sudden? That seems a little irrational.
Right. Well, the interesting thing, and this is kind of a behavioral economics thing, if you want to think of it that way, is that sometimes when there are sort of panics in debt markets, sometimes companies that are extremely fundamentally sound can see their interest rates go up, which ironically makes them fundamentally unsound. So it's kind of unfortunate. So it's like, well, they can't pay 7%, but if you had left it at 5%, they might have been just perfectly fine.
Well, that's a great point.
It can sort of snowball on itself.
Well, that's a great point, because you could then have a country. Any country could find itself in a disaster situation if the markets get spooked for some reason, right? You could have a country that has a very low debt to GDP ratio, but it's less likely in that case.
Yeah.
Okay, but if all of a sudden the markets get spooked and the CDS spreads go through the roof, then they're not going to be able to refinance their debt, even if it's a relatively modest debt. And they could find themselves thrown into bailout situations as well. So, I mean, that's actually a frightening situation. It makes it seem as if no political leader, no matter how prudent they are, really has control over their financial, their nation.
But aren't we seeing that funds actually flow to the governments whose bonds are more solid from the governments whose bonds are less solid? So, I mean, even the United States is able to sell its bonds because as bad as our government financial condition is, the other governments are worse.
Is that really
the
case?
I mean, in fact, supporting that, I don't know if you've noticed, but generally when we have these sell-offs and spooks in the markets, Treasury bonds have been doing well on those days. I mean, today's a great example where interest rates had fallen dramatically, right, and the dollar. Well, today was basically a deflation trade day, so it was. But I think you're absolutely right. I think people are perceiving the U.S. debt even as badly as we think, as we know the fundamentals will be in the long run, or on a relative basis, I guess it is better. But nevertheless, I still think Michael's idea still holds true that you know, you could be teetering on the edge between solvency and bankruptcy, and definitely a reaction in the markets can have a huge impact on you. So you're not completely in the driver's seat, you know. If you're a debtor, you're still at the mercy of market forces and the people who are financing you.
But it's also important to realize that a country doesn't necessarily have to hold debt. And so if you're not holding debt, then you're not subject to the market forces. I mean,
Jeremy, you're crazy.
How am I crazy?
What are you talking? Countries don't have to hold debt. You're just nuts.
Why am I nuts?
Did you guys
I'm being sarcastic.
Okay. Yeah, you know, and
you
I think we're living in
this?
An interesting time now where you're seeing all these countries have this tremendous debt, and the U.S. is number one there. Yet they're perceived to be safe, and that may change at some point. But, you know, as a consumer or a country, you don't have to have debt. And, you know, if my credit card company decided to raise my interest rates to 300%, 500%, it really wouldn't matter much because I don't have a lot of credit card debt. You know, and consumers that don't hold a lot of debt, the banks can do what they want. You know, it doesn't affect them. So, you know, but unfortunately, these companies and countries that aren't in that position, yeah, they're really subject to the market forces, and they can bankrupt them.
Did you have a comment, Jim?
Well, I was going to make an earlier comment, which was not entirely relevant, but I was just going to mention that the state of Nebraska does not go into debt. It's against the law there, which I think is interesting. I think it's the only state in the union that has that. Another comment would be that in the example given, if a government is fine paying 5% on its bonds but can't handle 7%, then it's really skating the edge anyway. Now, if you talk about an example where the rates go from 5 to 30%, then clearly that could have an effect, but it shouldn't have an effect immediately unless you're financing very short term. And, you know, that we can see that with our government right now. We've, because the short-term interest rates have been low and the longer-term interest rates have been higher, significantly higher, my understanding is that our government has gone towards more and more short-term financing. So if suddenly something should happen significant on the short end and our government would have to roll over its debt, then we could get into a very big problem in a very short time.
Well, and it was fascinating. I think there's a lot of lessons that countries can learn even from what happened in the financial markets in the last couple of years, right? We saw the auction, what was it, the auction rate bond, or the auction rate market, or auction rate bonds kind of blow up, which were a lot of municipalities that had been raising short-term debt, and they were finding it much cheaper to raise debt in the auction rate bonds, and it's worked fine for almost 20 years or so. And then all of a sudden, some very sound type of entities were municipal entities were finding the interest rates for the for their bonds jump 10, 15, 20% overnight. And I can understand how that was pretty jarring on that. And then also we saw a lot of companies that relied on continually on debt securitization as a standard way to operate their business and their financing, that when the securitization market dried up and people weren't buying the and there weren't those markets to purchase these short-term debt instruments anymore, some of those businesses were almost, some of them I think may have been driven to bankruptcy, but it was quite a disaster. So, you know, when your whole business model relies on debt, whether it's a business or actually your financial model of a country, when you really, really rely on being able to have liquid debt markets, I think that's something you should really consider about. That's a vulnerability. There's a real vulnerability there when you're relying on other people to provide you liquidity.
Right, and speaking about liquid debt markets, I was just reading that the bid-ask spread right now is so wide on Greece's debt that for the most part, people who own the bonds, you know, it's just too late. You know, they can't. It's not like you can get out on a momentum play once you see those rates sticking up. Like it is, if you own the bond, you know, it really is like hot potato when these things happen because it moves so quickly when there's a panic like we've seen. And now it's just too late for them to get out of those bonds at a reasonable price.
I just have to make a point. On some earlier things we were talking about, I think Jeremy actually said the U.S. is number one for debt. But is that really true? I do know what the Japan's national debt is much higher on a per GDP basis and I think per capita basis than American debt. I mean, I think Japan is in they have a debt in excess of 180% of GDP, and U.S. debt is what, less than 50% of GDP. So, I mean, I'm not trying to say the U.S. debt isn't bad, but that's the Japanese debt seems to be, their national debt seems to be far greater than in the U.S. And my understanding is there's many countries that have much greater relative debt loads than the United States.
Well, that may be true. You have to also include the unfunded liabilities, so Medicare, Social Security. Also, I believe that Japan is a nation of savers, where we're, you know, marginally so. I guess it revised them, and it turns out that we didn't go negative on savings, which I'm sort of questioning, but apparently those numbers were revised. So, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it's not like you have to have the badge of number one debtor as a nation to GDP. You know, there's a certain point where you get yourself into too much trouble and the markets then correct yourself. So I don't think you have to be number one to get yourself in trouble. Look at our bond markets. We're clearly not having any issues. Jim pointed out that we are, you know, the Fed is basically rolling over on the short end, and that's what's going on. And they're able to do that quite well. It'd be interesting to see if they tried the long end and still be able to get away with it. You know, there's some speculation that they might not. But, you know, so far things are fine. So,
I gotta say, I mean, if things start to get a little bit worse in terms of the credit markets again, we have another crunch period, the U.S. is just going to be so unbelievably lucky to get through this if our interest rates fall because of a safe haven buying. While the opposite happens in a lot of other countries. I mean, because Congress has just been so incredibly irresponsible with the massive amount of spending and borrowing and bailouts, and it's just unbelievable how quickly they've run up this debt. So, you know, to get that, and if we get through that, it's just going to be just incredible luck, I think. Because I think if you keep pushing it, no matter how good we look now, if you keep pushing it, you know, we could definitely end up like a lot of these European countries.
So what are you saying then, that the U.S. is not the ultimate safe haven for sovereign debt? This isn't the place where everybody should be putting their money. Everybody shouldn't be running to buy T-bills to make sure that they're safe.
Well, no, I'm saying that, yes, I believe the U.S. is still relatively safe if you're looking in the sovereign debt markets, but I'm just saying that we're lucky that it still is, given the drunken sailor approach to spending that's been going on and borrowing. And, you know, if that continues and accelerates, then, you know, that could change my opinion about that, and we would see it reflected in interest rates. Especially with the large amount of short-term issuance that the government has done, that Jim pointed out, which is sort of like an adjustable rate mortgage on the country.
Just a note to our listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Call in anytime at area code 917-388-4810.
Michael, going back to your original question, one thing we might look at is whether the financial situation in any countries is improving or whether it's getting worse. Now, I know only one country at all well, and that's the U.S., and our financial situation is getting worse, even though the problems of our financial situation are talked about all the time and at length, nothing is being done to improve the situation, and the spending goes on and the tax revenues go down and the longer term interest rates are going up. So it's getting worse. It's getting a lot worse. And I wonder about the other countries, and if it's getting worse for the other countries as well, then that would seem to be an indicator that maybe the Greece and Portugal and Italy and so on situation is something that needs to be taken very seriously, because the conditions are ripe for it to spread.
Well, isn't there being quite a boom actually going on in some resource countries like Canada and Australia? I know the asset prices are really rocketing in Canada, and everybody up there, a lot of people anyway, seem to be pretty thrilled about how well their economy is doing.
Yeah, Canada is certainly one. They're going to increase interest rates. The Bank of Canada. It's interesting when you look at the Canadian real estate prices, though. Vancouver has actually surpassed its high back in 2007, 2008, and so has Toronto. But it seems like it's in Canada. I can only address, but it seems like it's in certain areas. So it's really only Toronto and Vancouver, for instance, where real estate prices have actually surpassed, where in the other provinces they're below their all-time highs back in 2007. So you're kind of getting this non-confirmation, as technical analysis analysts would talk about, in markets. So whether or not that's going to continue, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I talk to friends that some of them are unemployed as well in Vancouver and in Toronto, and it's still a little bit more difficult to get work, but I'd say that they certainly haven't experienced the downturn that we've experienced here in the U.S.
Well, and I can say, even talking with my relatives in Nova Scotia, they've never seen the same degree of bubble that's been anything close to what has occurred in Toronto or Vancouver, but they certainly don't feel the major impact from the recession, and things aren't all that bad there. Real estate prices haven't dipped hardly at all. Things have been quite stable, and so there's certainly, I wouldn't say, there's certainly a state of contentment is what I detect, even in Nova Scotia. Whether you'd want to call that complacency or not, there certainly doesn't seem to be any severe panic going on. But, I will give the context, and I've mentioned it before. I have read that in Canada, they've been doing similar things with you take real estate, the Canadian government has been undertaking massive stimulus similar to the U.S., and the huge percentages of mortgages in Canada are now underwritten by the Canadian equivalent of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
So, Jeremy mentioned earlier about the Greece situation and mentioned that the IMF might be involved in that. I did hear briefly about that, and, part of me was thinking, oh, great, there goes my tax money off to some other thing I don't support because, I think it's better if countries live within their means. But isn't this also kind of a normal thing? Hasn't the IMF been bailing and sending money all around the world ever since it was created? I mean, isn't that all basically coming from U.S. taxpayers and dollar holders?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not uncommon for the IMF to intervene and get involved in countries that are having issues. I just find it funny because there's been this turn of sentiment towards bailouts and attack on banks and big banks here in the U.S. and sort of the blue collar, not in support of the white collar, these big bankers and their bonuses, and yet here is another bailout, and I'm just surprised it hasn't gotten much attention yet. But I tell you, if I could do it all over again, I'd probably work for the IMF. It sounds like a pretty cushy job. And they get like the Harvard and the Yale graduates, so they really go for the high education.
Look, I have a friend who used to work at the World Bank, so I can tell you some intimate details about it, but none of the things he had to say were pleasant. I don't know. I'm wondering if we should save that for another show, and we could dedicate an entire thing just to central banking and talk about it then.
And it would be better to have a friend on the show.
Sorry, what?
It would be great if you could get your friend on the show.
Well, it's possible, but the basic thing that he thought is that he didn't think people were giving as much consideration as they said they were giving. He would hear people sitting, you know, like guys in an elevator, and they'd be talking about how many millions or they should give to this country or that country, and they said decisions were made just on an elevator, and he was amazed at how casual it was for the amount of money they were talking about, and they were just like, oh yeah, we'll give them $30 million. Oh, but this guy might get angry if he goes, all right, give him 25 and give the other country the other 5. Like, they said that was like what the conversation was like, and it's just unbelievable. And I could go on and harp on about his experiences at the World Bank, but the whole thing is basically like, to him, he said it was not what he was expecting. He thought it would be a very professional thing, but it was not.
Well, getting back to Greece, you know, we've been talking about all of the general problems with contagion and with sovereign debt, but you know, the Greece is a special situation in that this is a Euro nation that's been having problems, and that gets into all of the angst around the future of the Euro and what would a default by a Euro nation really mean. Would it really impact all the other countries or not, the other Euro nations or not? And I think that makes Greece a little different than an Argentina or a Turkey or someone else who doesn't have their currency tied to many other countries.
Well, I think having your currency tied actually kind of handcuffs you because you're not able to print. You're not able to debase your currency. So, you know, so yeah, that's probably what's causing these issues to surface a little quickly, because you're actually backed by something. I mean, you know, if country was backed by gold, you couldn't print currency, you would have similar issues. You know, but what would they do? They would probably end up coming off the euro and going back on their own currency, and then basically perhaps being reckless if they continue their programs, and then defaulting in another way, much like Zimbabwe. So,
right.
You know, I don't know. Obviously, it's having huge impacts to the euro and something like that, especially if it acts as a contagion, will have major impacts on the euro. But
would it really? I mean, would strong euro nations really see much of an impact by a Greek default? Or is that just is that simple fear that people have? Is that just an irrational fear of the markets these days?
Well, you have to remember that these economies are tight because they're very close to each other. So if these countries go into bankruptcy and their consumers aren't able to consume, you know, it's going to have an impact on production-based economies like Germany. So. They're somewhat intertwined just because of their and even also in the United States as well. I mean, for whatever the U.S. produces, if these countries are having hard economic times, they might not be purchasing the amount of goods and services as well. So I think from that respect, they could have some impact to the general economies of the neighboring countries.
But why would I don't understand why it would impact German bonds to any great degree just because Greece defaulted on its debt obligations? Why would that have any more of an impact on German bonds than, say, a default of Brazil?
Well, the thing is, all of these countries and all these are forming these incredibly complex financial networks, like a game of dominoes. And there are so many, like, I'm sure there are plenty of German banks that are stuffed with this, you know, Greek debt. And I'm sure there are German companies that have their savings in a German bank. This is just an example, right? And you know, they default, and then the bank goes under, and then the company loses its savings, it goes out of business. I mean, there's just so many things, because the amount of debt and credit out there is so immense, and it's just... all kinds of relationships are there that are very hard to sort of you know, to know about, that are going to be affected, I think, if the default happens.
So your take would be that German bond rates would be impacted quite negatively by a Greek default.
I don't know. That's speculation, and I don't know if that would happen. But I'm just saying that if they default, then other countries who own that debt in their banking systems may have to bail out their own banking systems. And if they don't have the money to do that, they might have to borrow it, and that would bring up their rates. So, you know, the damage is done. When Greece borrowed more than it could ever repay, that's when the damage was done. Now it's too late. Now all they have to do is figure out who's going to pay. Is it going to be the bondholders, or is it going to be socialized in these other countries somehow, or is it going to be bailed out and the U.S. taxpayer pays for it? The only question now is who pays, but the losses are already real. So, and I think the only answer is that Greece needs to you know, I think a lot of these countries that have taken on too much debt just have to they have to buckle themselves down. That's really the only way to do it, I think.
So, well, yeah, I mean, another point about the debt crisis, we've touched on it a little bit, but I do find it fascinating to watch the policymakers and the political leaders and how their gut reaction is to be calming and to talk about how there's no problems. But yet it's obvious that they really don't have a lot of control over this stuff, right? If the markets keep driving their interest rates up on their nation, regardless of what the politicians might say or whether they actually believe, even if they believe it, it's kind of irrelevant. If the debt prices get driven up to such a degree that the nation can't refinance its own debt obligations, then it's up the creek, and they have to have a bailout or they're going to default. It's one or the other. And so I find that quite fascinating watching this. And so many policymakers have egg on their face right now. I mean, of course, the Greek leaders, but not even just Greek leaders, even the people like the president of the European Central Bank, Trichet, I believe is his name, because he's made – Jean-Claude Trichet, I mean, he's made claims about how they wouldn't take any – they would never take compromises in their rules about euro price stability or various obligations that member nations would have to meet. But then he's backed down on all of that, and the ECB has allowed Greece to have a bunch of exemptions on various types of criteria that they're supposed to meet. So, I mean, you know, how can you trust any of these people? Whether they're telling bald-faced lies, these leaders and policymakers, when they go out and talk about it or not, is irrelevant. Even if they believe it, clearly we see that the markets can force their hands.
Well, I think that's the bigger lesson. It kind of reminds me of, was it Bear Stearns or AIG, but essentially a week before the company went bankrupt, the president was on CNBC assuring shareholders that there were no issues. And that there was no problems, there was no fear to be in their debt or in their stock. And I find it amazing that their egos are to such an extent that they believe that essentially that by going in front of public, they're able to calm the fears. And that's just not the way it works. You know, when, like you say, the market can force politicians' hands, and you want to, as a politician, be on the right side of the market, or you're going to run yourself into a lot of trouble.
Well, just the very act of going out and saying that things are fine in itself is a sign of weakness.
Absolutely, yeah. There was a great book. I can't remember what the name was now, but I was reading
about the guys that were successful at actually doing the housing market, the housing market collapse. And one of the hedge funds that was in it, when he saw this on CNBC, he said, you know, that was his sign to get out, because the very fact that he had gone on television and was making his claims, he kind of asked himself, why? Why was he doing this? I mean, if things were really fine, would he have to go out and make these claims? And that's when he decided to sell the shorts that he had on the housing market with this firm, because he was concerned that the stakeholder on the other side, which was this firm, wouldn't be able to pay their debts. So, yeah, absolutely.
So on that theory, then, investors should be very worried about Spain and Portugal right now, and Italy, actually. Because all of the leaders in those countries are going on TV every day saying that there's no problems here.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I would not be wanting to hold any European debt right now. I just want to be holding treasury. Even there, probably just shorter term, unless you feel like speculating.
Well, do you feel that way about all European debt or just Euro nation debt?
Well, I guess I haven't done enough research to say that about all European debt. I'm sure there are probably actually countries there that are better off than the U.S. is.
Switzerland, say.
Yeah, exactly. But a lot of the Euro nations, and even if they're doing pretty well, I'm worried about the Euro itself. And so just owning something denominated in it, it's probably not a great idea either.
Well, the U.K. is not on the Euro.
Right. Yeah, and I don't know enough about their situation, so I'm sure there are plenty of exceptions. But I think, you know, and we talked about this on the show before, that there are going to be fireworks in that whole region, so, you know, you have to be careful with the Euro and any debt denominated in the Euro.
What about you, Jim? What countries do you think people should be focusing on to buy sovereign debt?
I think I have to beg off that one. I haven't studied it. I did hear an opinion from somebody I respect, I don't remember whom, a while back saying New Zealand might be a good way to go, but I don't know if that's still true.
Yeah, well, I can't. There's some countries I know I'd stay away from, and Spain, Portugal, and Italy certainly, and Ireland come up there pretty prominently, and I likely wouldn't be getting too close to UK debt, just looking at their government spending and the problems their economy's been having. But beyond that, it's kind of hard to tell. I mean, there's even countries like the U.S., I think that in America, you know, not even just in America, I think the U.S. attracts a lot of criticism internationally. And domestically, there's a lot of criticism of U.S. policies and so on, myself included. I am not at all happy with many U.S. Fiscal policies. That said, I mean, when you look at a lot of other nations around the world and their policies, a lot of them are pretty bad, and in some cases, barmier than the United States. And so I think it's not so easy to just say anything but the U.S. is where you should go.
Right. I've also heard good things about Singapore, so I'll throw that one out there as well. If you're looking for something, a place that has a reasonably good chance of paying you back.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing for sure is, I mean, if you look at the track record the countries have had in, say, the last 20 years on their, or 30 years on their own debt, and any country that's had defaults, I would really seriously question. So, I mean, that makes most Latin American countries would lead me to be suspicious of them, except maybe Chile, could be one of the few exceptions. But I mean, that's also why I don't, it's hard for me to understand why people would have thought Greece was a good place, because it wasn't too long ago that Greece was a very questionable debt market.
Oh, yeah, Greece has defaulted several times. It's kind of funny how people forget that, you know, and that countries are prone to default, even these European countries. So, you know, there's no question you want to look at track record. Although countries change too. I mean, you know, even Singapore, if you look back over 20 years, you know, and then today, if you look at the Fraser Institute, who puts out annually a list of countries that are the freest countries, so the countries that support free markets and liberty and property rights, Singapore, I believe, is second, and I believe Hong Kong is number one. The U.S. is like fourth or fifth. So, you know, these countries can change very quickly and turn into fiscally responsible countries as well.
Yeah, and then you can have countries that seem to be fiscally responsible who run into a lot of trouble. And weren't there some nations in the Baltics, like Estonia or some of those countries that seem to have very good free market developed very free market economic policies and really found their bonds and currencies get slaughtered in the last few years?
Yep. One last thing I would like to throw in, since we're running a bit low on time here. It's amazing to me just the amount of the bad financial situation, at least for the U.S. I don't know the exact timeline for a lot of European nations, but I might assume it's similar, who knows, that we've gotten ourselves into in such a short period of time. It's really only been the past decade that this has happened. If you go back just to, you know, the Bill Clinton era, I mean, we were about to, we had almost eliminated the debt. In fact, I think there was actually an interview with Alan Greenspan where he said something like, you know, he was worried if we didn't have any debt, he says, then where would we park any kind of surpluses? What would we invest them in? Because he only wanted to put them in T-bonds. He wouldn't want to put them in anything else. That was kind of amusing. But it's amazing how we can go from that huge surplus to where we are now in just a mere decade.
Just a second there. My understanding is that when things were the best that things have been, and this was in the late 90s, there was like 1 or 2 years where they actually were paying down the debt. But it was
right.
In no way was the debt eliminated. It's just that for the first time in many, many decades, the United States was actually reducing its overall debt. But that only lasted.
I think you're right. I was misinterpreting that.
Yeah,
well,
that only lasted for 1 or 2 years.
And you couldn't count unfunded liabilities there either, because it was the Social Security and Medicare revenues that were helping to pay down that deficit.
Yeah, and I think what Elliot was alluding to as well is that they were targeting, given the fact that we were paying down the debt, they were targeting that the debt would be paid off, and I believe it was like 10 or 15 years or something along those lines. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. We weren't out, but I think we were sort of trending towards, you know, being debt-free. What a distant memory.
Well, thanks for calling in again, guys. It's always fun talking, and I look forward to having you call in again next Tuesday night. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to the Financial Roundup with the Optimistic Bear and guests. Be sure to tune in next Tuesday. We're on the air at 9 p.m. Pacific time every Tuesday. And next week, we will be talking about central banks. I like Elliot's idea, so I think we'll stick with that for next week.
Right, unless something big happens between now and then.
Well, central banks will still be whatever happens. I'm sure central banks will be involved with it in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Mike.
Bye, guys.
Thanks, Bye, Mike. Y'all.